The Beer EDU Podcast, Episode 94, Restorative Practices with Stephen Whitmer. Welcome to the Beer EDU Podcast, the podcast for educators that love to learn and share ideas with fellow educators over beers, with your hosts, Kyle Anderson and Ben Dixon.
Hey, Kyle, how are you doing, my friend?
Doing fantastic, Ben. How are you?
I am great, and this is another episode of the Beer EDU Pod, episode 094. I am Ben Dixon. You can find me on the Twitterverse and on Instagram at BDixonNV. And you, my friend?
Kyle Anderson, special education teacher. You can find me on Twitter at AndersonEdTech. Same thing with the Insta. And then my blog, AndersonEdTech.net. And then my book, To the Edge, Successes and Failures Through Risk-Taking, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, other fine online book establishments, from what I understand. So let's cut to the chase. We got drinks, but this time, Ben, you don't got beer.
I have something different. I have Lagunitas Hop Water. So it's called the Hoppy Refresher. And I believe we have talked about this on a few episodes back.
Yes, I actually had it one time, and then we talked about it in an episode because I was so intrigued by it.
Well, and I'm trying to remember, did you have it? It wasn't on tap, was it?
No, it was a bottle. Okay. I got it at like a Buffalo Wild Wings or something like that.
That was what it was. Okay. Yeah, so after we talked about it, I started looking for it. So I found it at like my local grocery store, and it is actually, it's really good. It's it does have a hoppy taste, not overpowering. But it kind of just tastes like hoppy water, I guess. I mean, it's hard to describe.
The best thing that I can say for it is, and I may have mentioned this before, is that think LaCroix or bubbly, but instead of a fruit flavor, it's hops.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, I don't even know if I can, I haven't even looked on Untappd because I've cracked one. And then this is my second one. It comes in a 4-pack. So yeah, I mean, it's what it sounds like.
Yeah. And it probably would raise some eyebrows if you drank one at work, but luckily most of us are working from home right now. So
there you go. Well, yeah, it still has that Lagunitas, very distinct Lagunitas logo on it. So yeah, someone might have some questions, but hey, you, my friend, have something different.
Yeah. So last episode we were talking about the Dunkel, and that fired me up to go to my local big box liquor and beer retailer and do a little digging into the ethnic beer aisle. And they have a whole section on German beers. And I came home with all sorts of German beer that day. I actually did find a Dunkel lager and brought some of that home. And then I brought home just a standard Munich lager that I thought was really good. And then I found a bottle of this stuff, and I'm going to destroy the name because again, it's in German and I don't speak German, but the Kloster Ondex Weissbier Dunkel. So this is a Dunkel Weissen, dark Hefeweizen. So really good, smooth notes of banana. And then because of the darkness, you know, like a little bit of toasted bread. So I'm likening this to like, it's obviously a cold beer, but it's not. So it's not 100% like fresh out of the oven banana bread, but that's kind of what I'm getting is like banana bread on this beer. And there's no fruit or anything added. This is strictly water, hops, yeast, and malt. So you're talking that the wheat and then that yeast, that special yeast that they use for these things. That's where that banana and the spice is coming from.
Oh,
it's really good stuff. So, and it's a bomber bottle. I think I paid like maybe $4 for a from Germany bomber bottle of Hef or Dunkelweizen. So I'll go back and get another bottle of this. This is really good stuff.
Awesome, man. I'm going to go look for that one for sure. But hey, so if this is Beer EDU Pod, we're talking about beer. We also have a guest. So we're going to welcome Stephen Whitmer to the show. I hope I didn't mess your last name up there, Stephen. And thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. You actually got the name right. Most people don't, unfortunately. But yeah, I appreciate it. So I'll go ahead and introduce myself a little bit. Stephen Whitmer. I go by Steve. You know, born and raised in Florida, pretty simple guy. I had the opportunity to play college football up in Chicago. So that was a wonderful opportunity. After that, I started my, you know, special education run. I've been in special ed for about 10 years now. I worked in a suburb as a teacher's assistant. Then my journey kind of took me back to my hometown in Florida. I was able to be a one-to-one paraprofessional to a student with muscular dystrophy. And I have to say, he taught me way more than I could ever have taught him. Wow. Shout out to Sam. He's going to be listening to this. This phenomenal kid. And then life took me back to Chicago. That's where I currently work, at a therapeutic day school in a suburb of Chicago. I started out as a paraprofessional, but then I got promoted to an intervention specialist job, and now I'm the assistant director of intervention specialist services throughout the organization.
Awesome. So what school did you play football at? I'm a former college football player myself.
Hey, there we go. So I played guard at a NAIA school in Deerfield, Illinois, Trinity International University. It was a really cool experience. And, you know, in Florida, I feel like there wasn't, you know, as much as of a melting pot as Chicago. And all my teammates there, it was just, it was really cool to be able to play with people from Las Vegas, New York, stuff like that.
It's been a long time since I played football, and I still have dreams about it every now and then. Usually nightmares, because I had a coach that was just really, you're not 5 minutes early, you're 10 minutes late kind of deal. So I am never late for things, because I still have those nightmares about being late for practice, because the one time I was ever late for a practice, it was the I didn't throw up, but that was the closest I ever came to throwing up from working out in my entire life. That was intense. And I was an offensive lineman myself. I played center for a couple of years, and then I played tight end for the last 2 years. So, well, but you also have a beer on hand that we were talking about a little bit beforehand.
Yeah, that's right. You know, like I said, born and raised in Florida, I'm a pretty simple man. I have a Coors Light, keeping it simple. Yeah.
Now, going back to, we were talking with Ben with the hop water. So just a real quick side story. Years ago, I worked with a person at school, and we always ate lunch together, a whole group of us. And she came rolling in, grabbed her lunch bag out of the fridge, sat down at the table and started unpacking everything. And out of the corner of my eye, I see a silver flash of a can on the table. And I look over and there is a can of Coors Light, and I looked at her. I'm like, what are you doing? And she goes, oh, and she freaked out. Basically, she had cans of Diet Pepsi in her fridge and cans of Coors Light. And they do look a little similar, especially if you are very tired on a Monday morning. So she accidentally grabbed the Coors Light can and not the Diet Pepsi and brought that to work. So that's a fun story I like to revisit every now and then.
Nice.
Yeah. Everybody makes mistakes. Right. I know people that have had students that have accidentally maybe brought White Claw because they thought it was soda in their parents' fridge. Oops.
Yeah.
Don't do that, third graders.
So, Steve, tell us a little bit about that journey. I want to get into the details a little bit more about how every educator has their story and how they got there. So first, talk a little bit about like what got you into education in the first place. And then we can kind of start diving into like how you went from being a parapro and into the role you're in now.
Yeah. So I knew, you know, early on, I think most football players think they want to either go pro or they want to be a coach. Right. And that's something that kind of drew me was to be a coach. And when I went to college, I started studying, you know, to be a teacher, but things fell through. I had my daughter at a pretty early age. So at that time I needed a job. And, you know, I looked at myself and I knew I loved work, being in the mentor programs at my college and at my high school, mentoring younger students. So that was something I was really passionate about. And honestly, you know, when you're around 20, 21 years old and you're trying to get an education job, there's not many paraprofessional jobs out there that are in regular ed. So I was kind of, you know, cautious at first, but I decided to take that leap. I decided to work with behavioral disorder students and emotional disorder students at it was at a public high school, but it was their special education wing. So I decided to work there. And, you know, that working there day in and day out, seeing the students with troubled past and seeing what I could do to help them was really something that drove me to continue my education, get my degrees, and, you know, get into a position where I can impact these students' lives at a greater level than just a paraprofessional in the classroom. Now, don't get me wrong, paraprofessionals are amazing, but I wanted to continue that and get into a bigger role so I can impact the majority of the school as opposed to one classroom.
Yeah, for sure. Those parapros, man, they're lifesavers.
Yes.
A lot of times, especially I know, Ben, you can speak more from experience than me, I'm sure, about just the impact your parapros have in the schools you've been with.
Oh yeah, that we have several. I mean, I'm lucky to have a self-contained program with students with autism, and so I have several parapros that work one-on-one with kids. And I have been very lucky to sub for my teacher in that program when we didn't have subs. And I tell my parapros, hey, you guys are in charge. I am here, and you tell me what to do. And I know they're all like, well, the principal's in the room. And I'm like, no. I really don't know. You guys have to tell me what to do. You are the professional. So definitely that is a job that is very challenging, as is to any sort of teaching special education. Steve, you have done these jobs. You have a special gift to help kids that are, you know, that need a little more sometimes.
So Steve, so that you started out then as a parapro, and then you got your credentials as a special education teacher. Were you in a self-contained program, or did you start out kind of like in my situation where I'm a generalist where I co-teach? What route did you end up taking?
So what I ended up doing was the second trip to the suburb of Chicago, working at that therapeutic day school, which they had about 120 kids, all, you know, either with all with IEPs, some with, behavior disorder, emotion disorder. Also, we worked with students who are on the spectrum as well. But I started out for about 4 or 5 months as a paraprofessional. But then an opportunity came up for me to be an intervention specialist, which is essentially a dean in our organization. So okay. I actually took that route, and I've been that for the past 5 years. So it's really interesting with, you know, our program too, the intervention specialist. What we do in that in the therapeutic day school is when a student's not regulated in class, whether it's from their own dysregulation through sensory or other modes of dysregulation, or if it's, you know, peer on peer conflict, that student now has a safe space to leave and go to an intervention office. And that's where I would work with them with another intervention specialist through their dysregulation. And then I would also get them back into class when they're more regulated, but also to teach two behaviors. That was one thing that, you know, I've really focused on in my career as an educator is behaviors are a teaching opportunity. You know, a lot of people say, oh, well, that student learned that behavior from his cousin or from so-and-so. Well, if they can learn behaviors, then we can teach the behavior. Yeah. So that's what, you know, we're trying to do there.
Yeah, there's just so many times where throughout my career, I've seen where students misbehave and they get sent to the office and then they get assigned some sort of discipline for it, but there's never any sort of like reteaching or to help to unlearn the behavior that got them there in the first place. And I know, Ben, you've talked about a student that you've had for the last couple of years now, often on the show, about where his safe space is your office and you get to hang out with him quite often as a result.
Yeah. And I think Steve, I love that idea of like, it's not a discipline necessarily. It's like you need a space to reset yourself and then you can get back in. So I imagine, Steve, like, do you do a lot of like basically one, like creating one-on-one behavior plans for kids, things like that?
Yeah. So we would definitely create individual behavior plans. And you know, what I really liked about our situation at that school was a student had a team. They had a therapist, they had a behavioral specialist, sometimes they had OT if they needed an occupational therapist, and of course the teacher and the program assistants or the teacher's assistants. And, you know, getting together, being on the same page is vital for, you know, all of our students, but especially in that setting. And we would come up with plans if a student, sometimes when they got dysregulated, they would go and they would throw a chair.
Right.
So we would look at every individual student and see what need do they need? What is their need that's not being met in class? Come to find out a student might feel like he needs to escape that fight, flight, or freeze. They're fighting, they're running away because they became dysregulated because all of a sudden math got hard. So when a student comes into the office, we help regulate them by, you know, doing some type of sensory, maybe playing with Legos, weighted ball breaks, something like that. You know, most students, if they're dysregulated, they're not feeling ready to talk to anybody, whatever you say is not going to get in, not going to be received. So getting them emotionally regulated and then being able to talk to them, you can game plan with that student and getting buy-in from that student. So then, for instance, in that scenario, we can talk to a student now instead of throwing it or tipping over a desk or throwing a chair. Why don't you just come to me? Why don't you just get up and come to me? And then eventually down the line, we'll give him a card to where he can say break and he can leave the classroom. So it's all progression, of course. But yeah, we definitely create plans and all like all that.
So then that, but you're not doing that right now. You have a different job right now. Am I correct?
Yeah. Yeah. So I got an amazing opportunity to be promoted to the assistant director of intervention services. And so that took me from one school of about 130 kids to now I'm over two schools within the same organization. But what I do is I alternate weeks within those schools. And one school is a primarily EDBD population with about 90 students. And the other one is a strictly autism program, which I had some experience with, but being able to go and learn from those people really, you know, added a bunch of tools to my belt or to my tool bag. And, you know, I'm able to use those techniques to help better support those students on the spectrum, but also for the EDBD students as well.
So then you're like, you basically are supporting both schools. And then it, it sounds like not only kids, but you're also supporting staff, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So in my role, I'm blessed because I'm not, at times I'm working with students, but my primary job is to supervise the intervention specialists at those locations, but also conduct trainings with all the staff, with the paraprofessional, the teachers. I even include the administrative team, the therapist. I'm able to train them on a wide variety of things, such as how to teach to certain situations. If a student isn't following instructions, we don't just call them out and say, hey, you need to stop talking. We actually have a script of you come to the student, you talk to them in the ear, as opposed to across the classroom. You're able to give a praise and empathy statement. That typically lowers the student's defenses. So if I come up to Kyle and I say, Kyle, you can't talk out. You got to stop talking. He's going to be like, well, what are you talking about? But I come up to Kyle and say, hey, you know, I can appreciate that you want to join Ben and I's conversation. But right now, expectation is to go ahead and we're not going to be talking. And, you know, along those lines, also a lot of restorative practices. We teach how to process with students after situations and how to teach the really teach the behaviors.
So now these are two schools where the entire population of the school are students with IEPs, students with various disabilities. Do you have any experience or do you work with other general education type schools, whatever, in this process? Or are you just working with these two schools for right now?
Right now, I'm working with those two schools. I do have 3 years experience working as a paraprofessional down in Florida. I think that's the end goal, though, is to be able to go around to public schools and talk about restorative practices and how to teach the behaviors and really share the good word of restorative practice and get that into the special or get into the general population. And, you know, I know a lot of my friends who are teachers in the general population, public schools, they say, you know, behavioral management is really just kind of up to them. You know, their administrative does give them a little guidance, but it's really what they learned in the in school. And what's interesting is if you look at it, education, we've evolved so much. We've with technology, we've added ProWise, we added Zoom, everything like that, right? But with behaviors and supporting behaviors, you really don't see that progression as well. So I think restorative practice is that natural progression in supporting students with you know, in their behaviors and their through their dysregulation.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious about that because well, here in Nevada, there's various studies done the last few years about the rates of suspension and expulsion for students, especially students of color. It was very, very to especially Black male students where the suspensions and the expulsions were going to. So there was a focus a few years ago on restorative practices in the schools to try to start preventing those things. So, which I'm not sure where that's at this point. But, and maybe Ben, you could shed some light on that a little bit.
We have and there is a Nevada revised statute from our legislature on you using restorative practices. So I do think in some things we are trying to progress. I myself have gone through the training multiple times. I think it's a game changer for schools in terms of re-looking at like kids that are but we say causing harm, like you caused harm, so we're going to fix the harm, and rather than a punish mentality, which I think, you know, we've all been there. That's kind of the system I went through in school. It's the system that as an educator I was trained under. So I'm looking forward to seeing that change. So Stephen, in your role now, I mean, I guess my question would be like, what does that role look like now? Are your schools back with kids in the building? Are you guys distance? How's that looking for you now?
So currently, started off the year in August, we brought in, we're actually a first grade through 12th grade school. So we brought in our elementary schoolers, we brought in our middle schoolers, but then around November, things started really hitting hard with in Chicago, in Illinois. So we had to back off. Currently for the past 2-3 weeks, we've been remote, both staff remote in their homes, and students are back. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily stop the unexpected behaviors with our students. So right? So we've had to really shift our focus and reinvent what restorative practice looks like in remote learning.
Wow. So yeah, I can imagine. And I think with kids with behavior needs and different learning needs, this remote format that we're all engaging in can be super challenging. I imagine that's put a little bit different spin, like you said, on restorative work. So what are the things you're doing right now to support your teachers and your kids with that?
The new norm is pretty rough nowadays. You know, all the remote learning, you can't physically work with students in a close proximity, giving them the weighted ball, giving them all of their coping skills. But I think my school has been doing a really nice job of still providing all the services that they need. If a student's in class and not necessarily following instructions, then our staff has been trained to use those teaching interactions or actually teach to their unexpected behaviors over Zoom. So they'll do a breakout room. They'll talk to them one-on-one. They'll coach them through some type of break, whether that's like jogging in place. Some kids have even gone for a walk. But those breakout rooms are really important. And then the staff, thankfully, the staff has a really good rapport with the majority of the students. So sometimes just talking really helps with that. But, you know, trying to, you know, empower our staff to know that the restorative practices that we did in the building can still apply on remote learning.
Well, I can imagine the class sizes are much smaller than, say, a typical school in that situation as well.
Oh, absolutely. Our school operates on a 1-to-5 ratio, which is great. You know, we have 10 students, typically have one teacher and a paraprofessional. At times we have two paraprofessionals to help out. Special education students, they're definitely, you know, they're a blessing, but they're definitely require a lot of support. So 10 students, 10 of my students would probably equal about 20 or 25, a general population.
Oh yeah. Yes. I've had that discussion with people. Like, are you finding through this through remote learning, are your kids, I guess we talk a lot about this, Kyle and I, and we've had like our kids engaging in this, like I worry about kids, especially kids with special needs, not getting that contact with people. So are your kids for the most part getting on, making contact with your teachers, those kind of things?
Yeah, for the most part, there are some students that are still kind of apprehensive about showing their face. So that's one thing that I'm very proud of my school is we don't require cameras to be on. That's a part of like trauma-informed practice, restorative practices is, you know, not requiring them to show their face, not having to put them out there. They could, you know, have potentially harmful, you know, home settings or settings that they're not proud of. So they might not want to get on because they don't want to perhaps have a parent or guardian walk by and become embarrassed or something like that. So we require them not to, or it's not a requirement to have their video on. And, you know, we've run to, you know, some problems with some of our students not wanting to come on, but, you know, the team then reaches out to a student, gets parent involvement and, you know, see how we can support them in getting them back. Actually, it's pretty funny you mentioned that. We actually had a meeting, we formulated a plan with a student. Because he was doing a lot of what staff was saying, attention-seeking behavior. But in my eyes, in restorative practices, attention-seeking behavior is really seeking connectedness. They want your connection, you know? Mm-hmm. So we set up times to be able, for him to be able to talk to preferred staff. We set up times for that student to have social time too, because that's something in special ed, you know, it's really hard for our students to connect with others, especially students on the spectrum as well. So that's something that we strive for, is we create breakout groups and have maybe for lunch or after school, they come in and they talk, and we've, and you know, have social time with a staff member, and we've seen our attendance go up from there. And it's really, it's really, you know, overall, if you look at behaviors and you think, okay, how can we punish them to be compliant? You're going to get a lot of pushback. But when you look at a behavior and you think, what's an intervention we can put into place? What's something that we can help with? Or what is that student, you know, what's his need that needs to be met in order for him to be in a spot to learn? And that's something that we've been doing. And, you know, we've gotten a lot of involvement from our students.
It's hard across the board for everybody, especially in the distance situation, but just hearing what your school is, I couldn't imagine how tough that would be. But it sounds like, because you already had a good relationship with students beforehand, because they've probably been at this school for especially the older kids, they've been at this school for a long time. So everybody pretty much knows everybody where you're at. Is that kind of the case?
Yeah. I mean, we continue to get new students, but for the most part, students have already a pre-existing relationship with staff. And, you know, that's something that we definitely use to our advantage.
But it just goes back, Ben, like we've had conversations of our own and with guests over and over and over again over the course of this podcast about the importance of those relationships. So, I mean, right there, that's mm-hmm. proof that the relationships that were already built before are making life easier for you and your colleagues because the relationships were there. And, you know, if there's anybody that's listening out there that still is on that fence about opening themselves up and really just getting to know students or whatever, I mean, this is proof. The proof is in the pudding right now, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you have to, we talk about this all the time, culture, you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And I mean, that's that saying. And it's like, you have to have a good culture. It starts with relationships, and especially kids that have different learning gifts, challenges, whatever you want to call it. Especially, I know working with kids on the spectrum, that relationship is huge. It is huge. And sometimes you don't know if you have a relationship until you realize, oh, we did have a relationship. So I applaud your teachers definitely for doing that. Do you find, like, so in this, it sounds like, you know, you have opportunities for students to interact with staff. Are there opportunities too for students to interact with other students, maybe in a social setting besides just being at school?
Yeah. So, you know, we do try to provide opportunities for students to engage outside of just the academic time. We're definitely blessed to have therapists who only have about 10 students on their caseload.
Okay.
And with that, you know, there's opportunities for peer sessions, which two students have both their therapists and they can engage in some type of activity. We also, our intervention specialist also pull students and have social time as well. It's really like everything special ed, it's all individualized. So if a student advocates for it, or we identify that need, then we make it a priority, go ahead and do that. That's addition to some of the lunches that they have together, some of the, you know, incentivized activities they have, whether it could be like movies on Fridays as a class, and they can comment mm-hmm. on the movie in the chat and stuff like that.
Yes, I know students, a lot of students that I've worked with are, that's part of that whole, they have social, they have behavior goals, and a lot of it is socializing with other students in an appropriate way, kind of what we talked about with restorative practices. And I do worry that as many of us are in remote learning. I mean, I'm very lucky. My students are face-to-face in my district. Kyle, where Kyle's at in Vegas, they're not. So I worry about our kids that they need that social interaction, because that's kind of like that social language piece. I mean, that's like, how do you have a conversation when your turn takes? Yeah, it's good to see that like schools are thinking about that. I mean, you know, at a therapeutic school, I would imagine that's a huge part of it.
Yeah, it absolutely is, you know. Understanding relationships with the students, understanding their own culture as well. And what we found in our schools, especially the schools with behavioral and emotional disorder students, is they need to be heard. They need to be able to voice their opinion either about school policy or community events that are happening. And what's a great opportunity is for them to talk to a therapist. And at times too, we allow them to talk in class and have open discussion about you know, their own cultures or things that are bothering them as well. And, you know, we're extremely blessed to have group therapy as well, where a therapist would come in and, you know, discuss different topics, talk about social emotional learning, things of that nature social interaction is huge. I mean, with all of our students, but especially students in special education.
Now, Steve, you also mentioned that part of your job is providing training for your colleagues as well. So what kind of training were you providing your staff before this whole thing went down? And then how has that changed now that we're in the situation that we're in?
Yeah, that's a good question. So before, like in-person learning, we teach a lot of de-escalation tips, being able to defuse situations when students do become verbally aggressive, verbally not compliant. You know, how can we navigate that while keeping the restorative practice, trauma-informed lens with the student? Also, we kind of talked about, you know, how we can help regulate a student, how we can close the loop with behaviors. So if a student has behavior in class and then they leave to go to restorative intervention office, when they come back, it's not just a, hey, good job, go sit down. Because you never know if a student's feeling anxious, staff doesn't know what they've been up to, student doesn't know. So we taught how to process with the student and their behaviors, of course. And then, you know, as we shifted, now we're teaching more concepts to staff. We have a little more time to be able to teach, like the circle of courage. That's something our school is based off of, the four components of that: mastery, independence, belonging, generosity. And we're able to teach our staff that, and then now they can use that in the language as well. So now it's not, you're not following instructions on Zoom because you're talking out. Now it's, hey, are you showing good belonging by talking out? Students will say no. Okay, so how can we move to show better belonging? And we've seen, you know, a shift in behaviors and that when we implemented the circle of courage. And then also working with the staff, showing them that they're supported. This time is tough, but continuing to use restorative practice is what, you know, needs to happen in order to, you know, support the students appropriately, but also it comes back and it builds a very good culture in the classroom.
I'm interested about this circle of courage because I haven't heard this before. So is that like your vision of your school, mission, vision? I mean, or tell us more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. The circle of courage is the foundation of our program. We have point sheets, and we give our students are able to earn points throughout the day and throughout each period based off the circle of courage. So like I said, there's four components of it: mastery, mastering skills, mastering new things, mastering yourself, independence, obviously they're independent, showing up on time, being prepared, stuff like that, generosity, helping others if you have a gift or if you have resources, helping others, and then of course you have belonging, being a part of the group, being a part of the community. So we took that was a Native American philosophy that helped build young men into men and raised youth that way. So we took it and we adopted it. So everything that we do in our school, we always circle back to the circle of courage. So with our point sheets, with teaching the student, even if they go to an extreme of, you know, trying to, you know, throw a chair across the room, we can talk to them. Hey, were you displaying mastery by understanding your emotions and regulating yourself? And then obviously that'll lead to more of how can we close that gap? How can we become masters of ourselves? And then of course the belonging piece, and that helps with perspective taking. If we ask the student, you know, was that good belonging? How do you think your peers felt when you did that? And that just all leads to teaching to the behaviors. So instead of students reprimanded and sent to the dean's office, comes back and everything's okay, mm-hmm. Now we can have that open communication while tying in the circle of courage.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I think I've heard of it before, but I haven't had it explained to me. Like, I think it's a great way to reframe that whole like positive. I mean, you're here and this is kind of the goal that you're working at.
Yeah, absolutely. I've done, I want to say 5 or 6 trainings across our organization about the circle of courage. And you know, while I work at 2 schools, I have a partner who's also an assistant and director of intervention services, Ms. Laura Grimes. And we play off each other. We come up with different trainings. And she was the one that actually mentored me when I first started out as an intervention specialist. And she was very big into the circle of courage, into trauma-informed practices. And that's what led me to reading countless books, countless resources with the circle of courage, getting bought into it. And then also I am a certified trauma practitioner with a focus in education. as well, because, you know, all that really ties into restorative practice and supporting students.
Yeah, while you're explaining that, I actually Googled it real fast and found all sorts of resources on Circle of Courage that goes into each one of those tenets in a little bit more detail. So I'm actually kind of curious to kind of dive in this a little bit mm-hmm. more now myself. So now, Stephen, where can people connect with you online, on social media or anything, so they can connect with you to learn more about what you're doing with your schools?
Yeah, so the best way to reach out to me as far as for restorative practice or education or anything, any topics of education, is my Twitter, Whitmer, Whitmer, Sped, S-P-E-D, Whitmer Sped. Reach out to me there, and I'm very open to conversations. I've shared a lot of content about how to support students through restorative practice, trauma-informed practices. I've even, helped an individual come up with some social-emotional curriculum for their youth group. He said he loved the Circle of Courage. How can we implement this? And I helped work with him to come up with some lesson plans for belonging and mastery, so he can actually, teach that to his youth.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody goes through, like, Steve, through your Twitter feed, I mean, you have tons of resources just looking at it. I mean, yeah, and you've got, you know, you're posting stuff from Castle, all those great resources. So if you're not on Twitter, well, I can imagine if nobody's listened to this show isn't on Twitter, but definitely, I mean, Steve's a great person to have in your PLN because he's got tons of stuff out there. So thank you for putting that out.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's been a crazy ride. I think I'm not big time or anything, but I still feel like 500 followers is a good chunk of change, at least for me, yeah. Right? But I got that, and I've only been around for about 2 months or so. So people are really gravitated to restorative practice, and I'm looking to grow. I'm looking to learn from everybody. But like I said, I can definitely be a resource if people feel compelled to talk about Circle of Courage, trauma for practice, restorative practice. I got you.
Well, right, listeners, on. That definitely means that you need to follow Steve here and boost those followers up a little bit and get in on some of the great stuff that he's sharing out there. So at the same time, keep our conversation going. Share some of your thoughts on today's topics by emailing us at info@beeredupodcast.com. Tweet us @beeredupod. Use beeredupod hashtag. I totally just said that backwards. Oh, well. Hit us up on Facebook @beeredupodcast, all one word. Follow us on Instagram @beeredupod. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at bit.ly/beeredu YouTube. By the time you hear this, maybe you'll start seeing a few beer tasting videos on the old YouTube there.
We should.
And again, follow Steven @WhitmerSped on Twitter. I was able to pronounce your name very easily. I grew up in Michigan. I pay attention to what's going on in Michigan. And Governor Whitmer, lover or hater, there's no in between with that woman right now. You can send us a voice message using the Anchor app. Please leave us a review in the iTunes store where you can find the podcast. And Ben, if people want to be on the show like Steve, how can they do that?
Yeah. So just go to our website, beeredupodcast.com. You click on that contact subscription info link, you fill out the guest form, and you get in the queue. You get the queue. We'd love to hear what you're passionate about, just like Steve. And then definitely somewhere else you follow Steve, but you also want to make sure you're checking out School Rubric, because they are featuring the Beer U podcast along with a bunch of other great podcasts. The mission of School Rubric is to help schools, educators, parents, and students tell their stories so that all stakeholders can make the best choices about enrollment and staffing. So check out School Rubric at schoolrubric.com, and then you can find all kinds of great content from a bunch of educators all over the world. And so, Steve, we'd love to have you stay around. This is the part of the show where Kyle is going to teach us something. And Kyle tipped me off a little bit to this one earlier this week. So what do you got for us, Kyle?
Well, this one's right up your alley. So I know. You're going to jump in on this one and kind of piggyback things. So whatnot. So, but I was taking a look at, we were talking about some food pairing a while back with beer. And I got thinking about, like, what is considered the best beer for pizza? So, and I mean,
the wet kind, I don't know what other kind.
Any beer, right? But no, in all seriousness, though, I did a little digging, and I found this website, craftbeerclub.com, and they write a blog on there. So now, so this is totally subjective by this author's point of view, but I mean, it makes a lot of sense, these things that are in this article here. So now, Ben, you and I have talked about this a lot.
I have literally said this statement multiple times.
Yeah, and I know, and that's why I put it in the notes here. So is that there isn't much better in the world that's, you know, pizza and beer. It doesn't get much better than that. Even when they're not that good, they still are, because there's no such thing as bad pizza and beer, just some that are better than others. That is a meme that we need to quote Ben Dixon on right there. So
they're just stages.
Totino's with a PBR is amazing.
Totino's with like a really expensive IPA is pretty amazing. I don't judge. Okay. I'm not. Yeah.
No. So, but according to this article, different beers tend to pair better with different pizzas. And so I'm like, okay, at this point of seeing this in the article, I'm hooked. I got to see what this guy has to say. So according to the author here, lighter beers like lagers and wheats tend to be better with cheese pizza because there's no ingredients in those beers or the pizza that are competing with each other. So they're just kind of balancing each other out. Then he gets into like pale ales, and his take is that pepperoni's the best. The hops in the pale brings out the flavor of things like the sauce, but it doesn't overshadow the pepperoni. The pepperoni still has its time in the sun. Then he says stouts are best with a mushroom and spinach pizza, which I'm like, first of all, I'm like, have I ever had just a mushroom and spinach pizza? I don't know. I don't think I have. So then I'm like, okay, let me see what he has to say. His take was the sweetness of the stout balances the earthiness of the mushrooms and the spinach. Totally makes sense.
Right.
But if it's a sweet stout, like you get into, like, say, a Great Basin Outlaw Milk Stout, might be a bit much. So if it's a sweet stout, have some sausage and onions on that pizza to kind of balance it out a little bit more. Okay. Fruit beers are best with Hawaiian pizza. Okay, that to me is like a no-brainer. Pineapple and the fruit coming out with the ham and the
I don't think that one took too. No offense to this author. I'm like, oh, you just stuck two things with fruit together.
Right. So that would totally make sense. And it's another conversation for another day, whether pineapple belongs on pizza anyway. I believe it does, but we're not going to argue about that with anybody right now.
No bad pizza again. Right.
Okay. So now, Ben, this is you and me right here.
Okay.
IPAs go best with supreme pizza. Okay. The meats, the saltiness of those meats and the cheese, the hops, they balance out the vegetables. You still can taste the vegetables from that.
Okay. So, yeah. I could see that. I mean, I will personally say, this is, again, my own personal opinion, that I will go with, depending on the pizza, the lighter the beer sometimes, if it's like a really heavy pizza, like that's like two, I feel like I'm getting, like one's filling me up more. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
And then he says that lagers with veggie pizzas, because the veggies can be front and center still, and then the saltiness of the cheese can be cut from the beer itself, so. Now, I put mine in, so I'm going to put you on the spot here.
This is what I want to know.
My favorite go-to beer for pizza, like, let's say, like, I only have one beer available, and I ordered whatever kind of pizza, so it doesn't matter. Sierra Nevada Pale Ale.
Oh, my God.
And the reason why.
I will not even lie to you. I have not even got that far in the show notes. That's my pick.
Okay, perfect. So now the reason behind why I feel that way is that Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, it's not too bitter, but it's also not too light. And it just like, to me, it just goes with just about anything you could throw at it, because I'm one of those people that, like, if I'm eating spicy food, I don't like an IPA with it, because to me, like, the heavy hops, like, just intensifies the spice, and then it's just not as enjoyable. So I'm more of a, let's have like a Miller Lite if I'm eating chicken wings or something like that. So, but then
that was been my next question, is what beer goes with chicken wings? Because I'm having pizza, then I'm having it's. So everybody out here who teaches primary has read the book, If You Give Them, I think it's If You Give a Moose a Muffin and If You Give a Mouse. Mine is like, if you give Ben pizza, then there has to be chicken wings.
Love it.
So I think that we need to contact the author of those books and see if we can do that.
I'm going to write my own. Don't worry.
Okay, perfect.
There you go. So, adult kids books, you know? You
got exactly. Hey, Samuel L. Jackson did it, and that book is hilarious. I'm just saying.
Right.
So, I just find it funny, though, that, your pick was the same thing. So,
dude, I swear. I mean, as soon as I knew you were going to put me on the spot, I started thinking about it, and I will agree with you that it's enough of a flavor profile in a Sierra Nevada that you're right. It won't overpower anything in a pizza that's super spicy. Yeah. So I would say definitely that would be my pick.
Yeah.
That was literally what I was thinking.
Yeah. Which, you know, once again, we didn't talk about this one ahead of time. I kept this one to myself to, put Ben on the spot come podcast time. And, it's just totally coincidental
And I think, I mean, I'd have to go back. If you were to like look at my check-ins on Untappd, the most check-ins I have will probably be Sierra Nevada. So a pale ale. That's just like that's always been my
go-to. I know I've got quite a few of those. And then I know Founders All Day IPA is right up there too. So because it's just such a versatile, easy drinker. So an IPA, that's a lawnmower beer, which doesn't happen often.
So I guess my question, Steve, is what's your go-to pizza?
Go-to pizza. You know, I alternate, you know, being in the suburb of Chicago, I have to have Chicago
pizza. That's why I had to ask. So
Right. I think we have this place out here called Lou Malnati's. If you love topping, amazing pizza. I mean, it's ridiculously thick. And if you like cheese, it's a Giordano's. Like, I don't know if the OG Chicagoans would really appreciate that answer, but for me, listen, I'm a big guy. I played football. All my teammates, they love those top two, Lou Malnati's and Giordano's Pizza.
Nice.
Yeah, I've been to Giordano's, the one downtown off Michigan Ave, in my day, and I enjoyed it. You know, and it's one of those things where, like, kind of like people in Las Vegas don't go to the Strip because it's like, why? You know, where it's like people from Chicago probably aren't going to Giordano's that often, you know, because like those are like the quintessential, like touristy originals or something, whatever.
Yeah.
So now being, you got to go with the Chicago pizza every now and then, which I totally agree with. You can never go wrong with a deep dish. What's your go-to beer with pizza?
You know, I either go with the Bud Light. I'm a big Bud Light guy, or, you know, some people give me slack for this, but a Blue Moon hits the spot every time for me.
We talked about Blue Moon on a podcast episode a while back. It's a Belgian wit style, and that is a very popular style in Europe. And it's a Blue Moon is not as good as other ones I've had, but I enjoy a Blue Moon every now and then myself. And I don't need the orange in it. I like to let the beer speak for itself. And then people that put other fruits like lemon and say a Hefeweizen, I'm not a fan of that. To me, if you're putting fruit in the beer, you're trying to cover something up. I'm 100% with you. I enjoy that Blue Moon as well.
And actually, that is like, there used to be a pizza place here in Reno called Blue Moon Pizza. And they did this amazing chicken barbecue. And they were one of the first, as soon as Blue Moon came out, they got it on tap. Cause it was like, oh my God, we have this pizza place. And that was like the first place I ever had it. And so that was definitely that the mixture of that, the Hef with a little bit of fruit, with a spicy barbecue chicken pizza, that's spot on.
Ooh, that does sound good.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, that does sound good now you say that.
Now I'm hungry.
Yeah, so I might have to go order a pizza now after this. And then, I was thinking too about how Blue Moon was my second legal beer. My first legal beer was a Killian's Irish Red because that's what my dad and my uncles drank at the time.
Right.
So, but I followed that up with a Blue Moon. So now I'm trying to think, what pizza could I get that go good with a Blue Moon, and what one could I get that go with a Killian's Irish Red? And I'm thinking something almost like a fruity pizza, I think, would be, or a veggie pizza with the Killian's, because the Killian's is so earthy, balancing out with the vegetables or the fruit, I think. So,
man, now I'm hungry.
Yes. So, well, Steve, thank you so much for taking some time out to join us today. You know, like I said, listeners, check out his stuff he's sharing online, because it's some good stuff. And the fact that you're only a couple months into your Twitter journey and you already got that good many job. People knocking on your door, that's good stuff right there.
And Steve, it's amazing the work you're doing as an educator. I mean, I think people who work, Kyle does this job too, working in special education, you're a gift to those families, a gift to those kids and your staff. And thank you for that work you're doing. And again, restorative practices and trauma-informed practices. I mean, it's no wonder people are hitting you up for information, because that is the thing. And if it's not the thing, it needs to be the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said earlier, you know, education it's evolving. Our academics are evolving, and our behavioral support needs to evolve as well. Guys, I really appreciate y'all having me on. It was my honor. Absolutely. Thank you.
For sure.
Well, thanks for being here.
Yeah, for sure. And then listeners, as always, thank you for listening. And until next time, may the malts and the hops be with you.
Right on.